Welcome to What in God's Name. She's Shana Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are doing current events and culture from a theological and philosophical point of view. You are in for 25 minutes of vigorous exercise in the realm of moral imagination and moral thinking. We're talking about abortion today.
Ooh, the big A.
But before we jump into that topic, Shana, I wanted to update you and our listeners about our fund drive appeal. We have a $1,000 challenge grant. Any new or increase in old donations will be matched dollar for dollar. So if you give $50, think of it as though you are giving $100. Our webmaster has made this easy. You can donate through our website. Just go to whatingods.com, WHATINGODS. Our landing page will have two buttons staring you right in the face. One is donating through our Patreon page, the other through our fiscal sponsor, Filmmakers Collaborative. So thank you so much for supporting What in God's Name.
Chris, I understand we're one-third of the way to our matching grant, so we're doing well for the beginning of Lent, and I just hope all of our listeners continue to support us so that we can continue to provide you with this mental exercise called What in God's Name?
An exercise in thinking and feeling.
Yes. Well, we can only hope.
On to abortion, Shana, and I wanted to mention two parameters that I thought of, and maybe you could think of other parameters about our conversation today. We're not going to cover everything, is one parameter.
Yeah. It would be way more than 25 minutes of show, yes.
But one goal I hope for us is that our listeners will come away and say, I had never thought of that. Because one of the values of our show is to get beyond what we generally hear in the public conversation. In fact, I don't think our show really is worth anything if we don't get beyond the usual stuff.
Yeah, I have a new tagline for us. What in God's name, getting beyond the binary.
I like it. I like
it. We'll put that one in addition to staying curious, going deep, and shining light, right?
Getting beyond the binary.
Getting beyond the binary.
Sweet. Second parameter, we will make some moral distinctions in our conversation today, but those are not to be construed as judgments.
Thank you for saying that, Chris.
Yeah, I think that's really important because part of a conversation about abortion really has to wrestle with moral complexity of each individual particular story and circumstance.
Absolutely. And, you know, for those of us, for any of our listeners who have had an abortion or know someone who's had an abortion, we know how difficult that decision is. Nobody comes to that decision lightly or without due reverence and care. So, you know, it is a complex issue, and I think it is important for people to know that this is it. We're trying to get into the topic and unpack it and understand some of the moral complexity. What we do not intend to do is judge.
So a jumping off point is this, that the pro-choice, pro-life binary, getting back to your revised tagline, that binary does not reflect how most people see themselves with regards to this issue. Most of us are not either pro-choice or pro-life. We could be both.
We may think that we are because the way it's been spun out in the media and in the public square is that you are either, you know, so-called pro-life or opposed to abortion, or you are pro-choice. So the way it's played out in the public sphere, I think people might think of themselves as one or the other. And I guess part of what I would like to suggest is that it is quite possible, certainly for those of us who are pro-choice, to also hate abortion, to hate everything about it, to hate the fact that any woman would ever be put in that position or have to deal with that issue is awful regardless of the reason. And so we may be pro-choice in that we want abortion to remain safe and legal and the purview of the woman involved, but that doesn't mean we're all like, yippee-yay-yay, go abortion, you know?
One way that the use of language can drive this binary is oftentimes I see a pro-choice position being characterized by those who characterize themselves as pro-life, characterizing the pro-choice position as pro-abortion.
Pro-abortion, yeah. You know, and as much as I can see room on the left where we may be pro-choice and still able to wrap our heads around the horror that is abortion, I wonder how many folks on the right would be willing to meet us midway, because part of the way that we would reduce the number of abortions necessary is to make sure that family planning is legal, healthy, accessible. Maybe in the same way that they don't know we exist, i.e. those of us who are pro-choice but wish that another abortion never had to happen. They don't know that we exist. We may not know that they exist. Maybe there are more people who would be willing to work on issues of family planning, willing to concede when the life of the mother is at risk. You know, there may be more, but again, the spin in the public square is either this or that. So it's hard for us to know.
In preparation for today's show, I recommended to Shana an article, and I recommended to you, our listeners, in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly, an article by Caitlin Flanagan. And in that article, she shares stories, real life stories, real life examples that just make your heart cry out for both sides, to use the binary for a moment. She tells a story that makes your heart cry out for a mother who decides to have an abortion and arouses sympathy for her circumstance, and then a different story that arouses sympathy for
the unborn.
Yeah. And what I loved about that article is I think that's where the conversation really needs to go to find its moral center, which is a compassionate, heartfelt connection to these stories, mm-hmm. both ways.
Again, I keep going back to that interview with Kathleen McTeague because I think about the place where those of us who are faithful and politically liberal or left of center oftentimes lose the capacity to articulate an argument based in our faith, because it's not simply the Bible said, but more about the virtues that we hope to be developing within the process of being people of faith, virtues like humility, compassion, empathy. At some point, we have to weigh the moral right of the mother over the moral right of the unborn fetus or child. And I know you were talking earlier about something you had read by Aquinas.
Yeah, let's make a pivot to that at the moment. Now, I've done reading in Aquinas before, and I had noticed that he makes a distinction in the development of a fetus as to when that fetus has a soul. And I thought, well, I want to learn more about that. And so in preparation for this show, I did. And the idea is, it actually has a name. It's called delayed animation. Animation not being understood as cartoons, but rather in the root Latin sense, anima, meaning soul. So this idea that a fetus does not have a soul at conception, but rather later on in the fetus's development is when the soul comes, the soul enters in. So Aquinas did not cite this as an argument that abortion was okay. But it does lend us pause to think about the rhetoric that talks about murder. The larger point is that the moral status of this fetus changes. And I feel that intuitively. Like there's a moral difference, a moral status difference between a conceived egg within the first, I don't know, let's just for the sake of example, take the extreme, like in the first 24 hours. Between that and an 8-month-old fetus that's almost ready to be born. And this points to the moral complexity, because at some point there's a shift, there's a change. And it only makes sense because fetal development by nature is this kind of development towards its humanness.
Although, and again, I realize we're using binary language here, so I've never heard those on the right argue about the humanity of the unborn child or not. It is simply the question of when does life begin? And I'm not sure for them that is a matter of, you know, when that fetus becomes animated with a soul. It may be a more fundamental question than that because of the commandment about thou shalt not murder. It then gets complicated, though, on the other side, because it seems to me that many of the folks that are, you know, really rabidly anti-choice are also have no problem with the death penalty, have no problem with children being born to parents who can't possibly take care of them, have no interest in children, you know, being born hungry. I mean, they're not working to improve those conditions. When Jim Wallace was interviewing Pete Buttigieg, Pete made the point that evangelicals are voting for Donald Trump based on the fact that Donald Trump is appointing anti-abortion judges. So they're throwing their faithful support behind a president because he's doing something that the Bible is absolutely silent on. But on those things that the Bible is very clear on, the requirement that people of faith take care of the least of these, that we feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those who are sick and in prison, that we look after the widows, that, you know, we support these family structures, that that we do not divorce. They don't seem to care about any of those issues. I don't take the Bible literally, but apparently they say that they do.
So I've been focusing on, in my little remarks there, on the moral status of the fetus, but you raise these questions that, again, are moral questions about the wider society. What kind of society do we want to be where we're bringing children into that society? So my point is there's so many moral dimensions to this, and I wouldn't want to mislead people into thinking that I think that the moral status of the fetus is the only piece, because mm-hmm. there mm-hmm. is there is more. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more.
The moral status of the mother, for example.
Which we'll get to in a second.
Okay.
Can we hold off on that? Because I wanted to say a couple other things in response to you. One is the sense of how we are using the political system to drive at this abortion question. And I think that reflects a failure of nerve or a failure of self-confidence in religion to be able to convince people of a particular moral position to have. There's an impatience and a lack of confidence. And so certain people with a certain perspective on abortion want to rely on the power of the state to get their moral position to be the winning moral position. Yep. And I think that's a huge mistake and actually a sign of really no self-confidence in the moral argument. Because I think the politics of this can only get better if there's a robust moral conversation where people can hear each other and get to someplace agreement
beyond the binary.
The binary, absolutely. Yeah. So I think anyone who's looking to the political power to solve what's a moral question is misguided. It's not going to happen.
Well, that's fascinating, because I think both sides, again, I slip into the binary, but forgive me for the purpose of conversation, both sides have leaned to the political. That having been said, I think those of us on the left, I think the mainline Protestant liberal perspective was silenced in the early stages of the abortion argument. And if you look at sort of the history and membership numbers in the church, you'll see that we went from the social gospel era, where the mainline Protestant churches were at their prime and just membership was exploding, to a hemorrhaging of members. And when that happens is right at about the time that this issue of abortion comes into the public square. And I've often thought it was because, you know, those who were anti-abortion were so shrill, angry, accusatory. They grabbed the Bible, they grabbed Jesus, they grabbed this so-called moral high ground. And I think those on the left were just so stunned that we got quiet. And it's interesting because when we got quiet, we started to hemorrhage membership. We lost our moral authority in the public square. And I think, you know, what you're saying is also true, which is today, where you've got evangelicals and those on the religious right leaning so heavily into the political system to support their position, it undermines the very foundation of what they're saying. If this is a faithful decision, if this is a decision based on faith, then make it based on faith and get it the hell out of the public square.
Well, it should be in, I'm sorry, this is a fine point, but it should be in the public square, just not in the political square.
Yeah, public square, not the political square. Thank you.
Let's turn our attention, Shana, to the moral status of the pregnant woman. There's this whole moral stance of the moral agency of the woman. And this idea of choice is really a perspective on empowerment for women.
Yeah, the notion that women aren't chattel. It's interesting, as you were saying that, I was trying to think, when was the last time I heard a man speak in the public square about a woman's right to choose? I mean, certainly, you know, in an election cycle, you will hear male candidates speak about supporting a woman's right to choose. But to come out and actually articulate a position in the way that so many men will do on the anti-abortion side. Yeah, we just don't have the number of men out there articulating the position. And I guess largely because what you're saying is true, is just that the pro-choice movement is a movement about empowerment.
Yeah, and power and agency is a moral, those are moral questions. They have to do also with fulfillment, like fulfillment in life and being able to direct one's destiny. We would support unequivocally, like we feel like each individual in life should be able to direct his and her life in the way that they see fit. And
so long as,
yeah,
I mean, there are restrictions on
so
that.
that's the thing. There are, yeah, go ahead and say.
Yeah, no, that there are restrictions on that. We don't just support the notion willy-nilly that people can sort of, you know, should be free to do whatever they want. There's, you know, there's issues around so long as it does no harm. And now we get back to, yes, but here we are around this issue of abortion and the harm that is caused. And I think one of the things the left has been unwilling to acknowledge that it is harmful. And the right has been unwilling to acknowledge that its position, if actualized, is harmful. That there is harm being done both when we deny a woman the right to choose, when we make abortion illegal, my God, and women are going back into these back alley abortions. You know, that there's harm. There's harm when a woman is, you know, stretched beyond belief and can't take care of the children. She and her husband can't take care of the children. They can't feed the children that they have. And their church is saying that you shouldn't use any protection during intercourse. You should, you know, actualize no family planning. And, you know, so they're getting pregnant and they're having more and more children who they can't afford to feed or take care of or send to college, or that there's harm. There is no way to avoid harm. But I think at some point, the issue we have to get to is choosing the harm that gives us life or choosing the harm that gives us death. And that is a much broader question than simply the life or death of this unborn child.
That's a perfect way to bring us towards home on this. In some of my reading, there seems to be a new kind of third way of trying to think about these questions, and your characterization of harm both ways is really, I think, a driving force in this. And I've just begun to do a little reading around in this, so I'm not going to be able to present the fullness of the moral thinking that's going on here, but I just wanted to tease it because I think it might be a fruitful way for moral conversation to happen on this issue going into the future. And it really is in response to this sense of, again, addressing the binary, that on the one side, the fetus has the right to life, and on the other side, this is a caricature for sure, on the other side, the woman has the right to choose. And so you have these two very hard binary positions. And so this new way is trying to emphasize relationality, taking the concept of fetal development and a mother's sense of maternal consciousness as essential for humanization. So it's really...
It's certainly a case by case. I mean, it certainly takes it down to a case by case, individual by individual. And again, it leaves it to the mother's choice because it's based on her degree of connection or lack thereof.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it ultimately does point to a, again, a pro-choice, but it aims to get beyond this individuality, this hyper-individuality that often characterizes this conversation about the right of this unborn child and the right of this pregnant woman, as though these could be seen in isolation one from the other. And if you start to think about this issue with regards to relationality, it's not just the relation of mother and fetus in womb, that relationship, but then it's also about the wider society, issues that you were raising earlier, the context in which families exist in our society, the context in which children are brought up in. It's not just a birth and a family in isolation. It's a birth and a family in relation to other families and wider society.
It's also, it's interesting to me because in the context of the argument about the individuality of the mother, the child, you know, this is always to me kind of interesting. It's like, so where do men come into this argument? Because if a man has been intimate with a woman and the outcome of that physical intimacy is conception, you know, we're seeing these arguments now play out in the realm of IVF more, where we're dealing with the material of conception as opposed to it being actually sort of connected to a, and who has ownership of what, and who, if a man and a woman engage in IVF and they get, you know, some eggs fertilized, then they divorce. There have been cases where, you know, where the woman wanted to use the fertilized eggs then to have child, and the father was able to say no, because that's some of his material that went into fertilizing that egg, and he's not, you know, that brings a whole other dimension to this that I have not even begun to think through. So we may have to do another show on this.
But your point about if we try to frame this issue relationally, then certainly the man, the sperm, is a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We need to bring this one to a close. Shana, anything more you want to add today?
Stay curious, Chris.
Go deep, Shana.
Shine light, friends.
I've enjoyed this conversation with you today, Shana. Thank you so much for your
thoughtfulness. I think I have a brain cramp from this conversation. No, I have enjoyed it, Chris. It's just, it's made me really think deeply about the issue, and I hope our listeners have done likewise.
And since you have spent 25 minutes in vigorous moral exercise, go have a marshmallow or maybe rehydrate.
Exactly.
You can find us on Facebook at What in Gods, and of course, please support us in the funding drive at our website, whatingods.com, whatingods. See you next time, Shana.
Absolutely, Chris. See you.